Hi, welcome to Strange Fruit. I'm Kyla.
And I'm Jay.
And you are listening to Strange Fruit on WFPL.org.
Well, y'all, it's our last episode of 2012. It has been a wonderful year. However, we're going to take a week off and get our party on, you know.
Because the doll needs to rest.
We need to be well rested and spend time with our family and friends for the holidays. So we promise to give you all a wonderful show this week. You all take some time off, hang out with your friends and family. Make sure you come back and join us next year for a lot of really cool shows we have in line for y'all.
Yes.
Doc, take us right into Juicy Fruit.
Okay, so this week's Juicy Fruit has to do with Nate Silver, who was recently named Person of the Year in Out Magazine. Mr. Silver, while graciously accepting the award in an openly gay magazine, actually within the article states that they would rather be regarded as a good statistician than a good gay statistician.
And so in this article, he goes on to say that he feels like he doesn't lead a traditionally gay life, right? And I think he actually said something to the effect of sexually I'm gay, but ethnically I'm straight. And I think what he was getting at, although he used a very poor choice of words, was that he's a nerd, he's into computers and into all these kind of nerdy things versus what is perceived to be the usual stuff the gays are into, like fashion and pop culture, and I guess whatever as normal gays are into. So a very poor choice of words, but it does beg a greater discussion about really what does it mean to be gay. And
true,
somehow is someone less gay, you know, if they're not into those kind of things we mentioned, like fashion and music? And are gays not nerds? Are gays not into statistics and computers and books? Are they mutually exclusive, or can we be a little bit of every, you know?
Well, I do believe that, again, just like one of our earlier interviews with Dr. Gary Gakes shows, the diversity of the LGBT community, that we're involved in multiple communities with intersecting identities. And I think the disappointing things that Silver said, the most disappointing thing that Silver said in the statement, is this idea that homophobic people tend to use and indicate and say, this is why LGBT people or gay people are bad, because of their illicit lifestyle, their seedy lifestyle. I think it's sweet that you feel like maybe Silver was referring to fashion and these types of things, but I seriously think Silver is talking to the salacious nightclub life, seedy life, this idea that LGBT and queer communities are the underbelly of society, where there's illicit drugs and illicit anonymous sex and debauchery and immorality. And that's what Silver is really hinting at in what they're saying, is that it, because again, Silver says sexually gay, right? So we are to assume that he doesn't necessarily, though, identify with the gay lifestyle, quote unquote, is that I might be gay, but, and even in the quote that he says, you know, there was this billboard in Boys Town in Chicago, and this is where he actually comes out with the statement of ethnically straight, is that there was a mural or flags or something dedicated to an artist, and they named the artist and said that they were a gay American artist. And Silver says, why couldn't they just be an artist? Why couldn't they just be an American artist? And this argument not only transcends what Silver is saying, but all walks. A lot of people will say, why isn't Langston Hughes just seen as a great American author or a great American poet? Why is James Baldwin, why are they seen as black poets? And what I tell my students is that, one, the reason why we have to name something in a certain way, like black artist or woman, you know, female professor, and qualify those types of things, is that traditionally certain types of people have been prevented from certain types of avenues and production, scholarly works, these types of things. And so by taking that away, you are really erasing part of the history that even engenders the person to write in the first place. The reason why Langston Hughes is seen as a black American poet is because he writes what? About the black American experience.
Yeah.
And for Silver, who is getting an award from a gay magazine, as much as you want to shade the gay community community and say that you are so removed and you're a different type of gay or a cookie cutter gay or a gay that is more representative of American values?
Well, and I know I certainly respect that you read it that way, and perhaps I'm a bit more forgiving, but I didn't necessarily read it as him throwing shade to, or it's kind of insinuating that, that us regular gay folk are too salacious or seedy. I took it to mean that he recognizes that at some point he's felt on the outsides of the gay community, much in the same way that I, as a black man, can go to the local gay nightclubs here and feel like an outsider because I'm not some young, twinkie, 20-something white dude. You know, and so I will often speak to the fact that my gay experience is not the quintessential gay experience, which is probably the case for many people who are outside of the cookie-cutter, you know, twinkie young white dude, or you know, any
but
of us.
He is a twinkie young white
but
dude.
Again, but he is from your perspective. But from his perspective, he's half Jewish. You know, he's nerdy looking. You know, he wears glasses. You know, so again, I think from his perspective, he isn't. He doesn't see himself necessarily through the same lens that most of the rest of society tends to see gay folks. So if we turn, for example, to reality television and the gays that we see, whether it's the Housewives of Atlanta, the you know, the Shahs of Sunset, any kind of gay person represented on television is very rarely, you know, I'm not saying that what you're saying is invalid. I'm simply saying that I can see his perspective, because I've often felt like the life I lead is not the quintessential gay life. Now, certainly I can articulate that better and say that my experience is just a valid gay experience as anybody else's, but I think that he doesn't yet have the terms and the ability to articulate that. So maybe I'm just a bit more empathetic. I'm giving him a little bit too much credibility. But you do make a very valid point, though, about I don't get with the effect of, like, I don't want to be a gay podcast host. I just want to be a podcast host. No, I want to be a black gay podcast host. Mm-hmm. And we always talk about how much identity politics and how much the personal is political. That means a lot to us. And so for me, it is much, very much important that you represent every bit of your identity. And it's important not just for like a self-serving like soapbox, but because again, throughout my lifetime, there are far too few people who look like me who are doing successful things. So yeah, it's very important to me that I identify myself as a black gay man who's doing A, B, and C in hopes that someone coming behind me can, you know, can find motivation or inspiration in that. Because again, I've talked about before, when I came out, I thought I could either be a drag queen or a transsexual prostitute or some kind of sassy snap queen. You know, that's all I knew the black gay people could be.
Mm-hmm.
So, I vibe with you there, you know.
Yeah, no, I just think it's completely dissociative. I think it's cowardice. I think that if anyone ever said, if I got interviewed by a magazine and got an award for a year for being a dynamic black female professor, and I said, you know what, I just want to be seen as a professor, not black, not female, not lesbian, people would think I was absolutely absurd. But when gay people say, I'm not like the rest of the gays, somehow we all, right, including gay people ourselves, feel as if somehow that's valid because, like you said, our individual experiences don't necessarily mirror stereotypical ideas of what gayness means. My life as a black and female girl is not a stereotypical black female girl experience in the United States of America. But does that mean that somehow I'm going to disassociate myself from black Americans or black females because my individual experience doesn't necessarily mirror culture or the lifestyle that is seen to be associated by outsiders of my culture? Because again, Silver, the problem, a lot of the problem with his assertion is that his read of his own culture is informed by outsiders of
the
culture.
I agree completely. Right. I totally. I'm with you there. I'm with you there in that it's one thing to acknowledge that, yes, my life does not mirror what's been, but it's okay to claim that and say, you know what, but it's still an authentic experience.
Right.
And it's still just as much a gay experience as all these things that you think it means to you. So, you know, I vibe with you there. So, you know, again, if you all get a chance, you know, Google this story or pick up the magazine and you know, let us know what you think. So I want to talk about another bit of juicy fruit that we came across today, actually. And that was, apparently there's a magazine called Candy Magazine.
It's like candy.
Okay. And Candy Magazine bills itself as a fashion, the first and only fashion magazine completely dedicated to trans culture. And so on the newest issue, they have a transgender model, a black woman named Connie Fleming. And she's the cover model. And she is styled to look like First Lady Michelle Obama.
Yes.
So very much kind of bare arms, a cute dress. In one cover photo, she has her hand on a Bible taking an oath. In another photo, she is waving an American flag. And it's caught a little bit of flack. And the creative mind behind the cover says that this cover is an homage, if you will, to First Lady Michelle Obama, but also serves as an inspiration to the idea that hopefully one day a black trans woman could be president, you know, mm-hmm. in much of the same way that back in, I guess it was 08 when Barack and Hillary are, you know, prior to 08 when they were both forerunners for the candidacy for the Democratic Party, that they were seen as two very kind of controversial, you know, the first woman or the first black person. And he says that maybe one day, in the same ways that Obama and Clinton have broken down these walls, that we won't think like, oh, the first trend, you know. So, but some people have found it offensive and disgraceful and feel like, oh, it's not time for a trans woman to be dressing up, you know, like Michelle Obama or, you know, whatever. Not to mention that RuPaul has also done a take on Barack and Michelle that was very tasteful, mm-hmm. you know, not to mention that other folks have done takes yeah. on, you know, so.
And I personally don't see anything wrong with it. I see it as a beautiful photo spread. I think it's creative. People have been commenting and saying that it is a disgrace or being outraged, and I just don't get it. I think that the outrage, the idea that it's a disgrace or people getting so upset about this photo spread has more to do with people's transphobia
because Tyra Banks, Tyra Banks did
yeah.
what she portrayed Michelle Obama,
yeah.
you know?
I mean, and especially if people watch America's Next Top Model and all the hundreds of cycles that Tyra has had, it is typical for performers, creative people to adorn and embody the personas of the most visible
yeah, historic
in our society.
Figures. I mean,
yeah.
they, models do it,
yeah.
musicians do it,
yeah.
people's always being Marilyn Monroe, you know, people are always being Jackie O. You know, no one ever finds it offensive. So I think you're mm-hmm. right. I think it does have a lot to do with the trans embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, yeah, it's just,
and people being upset that, you know, well, how dare you be so audacious to pose as Michelle Obama? And it's like, what?
But not to mention that even, and it's something we can't even touch on. We don't have enough time to touch on about how contested Michelle's body is in and of itself.
Mm.
You know, her strong arms, her. You know, they characterized her very much as, oop, no shade, a black man. You know, she was very much mm. billed as an angry black woman, i.e. Reed, another black man. You know, and so mm. even just black women's bodies themselves are, you know, so I don't know. I'm not saying that people literally called her a black man, but
yeah.
I'm saying that very early on, people made her seem as she was angry. And very much of the criticisms the black women get are that they act too much like black men.
Masculine.
And you're so masculine that you emasculate your black man. The reason you don't got no man is because you're trying to be the man. You're trying to run out of the household. Yeah. You're trying to tell people, you know, so I think that clearly it's a much larger discussion, but I think it does kind of beckon and kind of call to mind those issues too, just about how, I don't know.
Yeah.
I might be reaching, child, but that's
yeah,
what
that,
I think.
Yeah, that's too much.
Well, that's what you think, child. That's what you think.
I don't always agree. I don't know. I do think that's too much. I do agree with
that. Oh, that's too much, child, but you could, but the silver dude. It's
no,
like,
silver,
yeah,
whatever. Yeah, well, that made sense to me, but I'm saying that there is a historical record, yes, and I agree with you on this, the historical record of making black feminine embodiment, couching that as a masculine performance or an extra strong type of thing, the whole strong black woman motif, I vibe with you on, but not in terms of this part. People are just upset because they don't like the trans kids to get life. That's just period. That's it. They don't like trans people. People are so angry about gender nonconformity and gender identity. I mean, people are in such an uproar over such insignificant. So insignificant. It doesn't matter. It's like, what does Connie looking sickening on the cover of the magazine have anything to do with you and the way in which you feel about the First Lady or whatever? And I'm sure Michelle probably didn't see it and left it.
Okay. So, child, that's what's got us juiced this week. That's what's got us all juiced up. So, as always, we'll keep our eyes and ears to social media and see what's going on. And, of course, if you have something juicy you want to talk about, always shoot us a Facebook message or tweet us and let us know what's got you hyped in your world. So that's this week's Juicy Fruit. We check in this week with porn star and producer Trick Wolf. Born in Vietnam and raised in Connecticut, Trick Wolf now lives in L.A. and created Slanted Tendency to promote and film pornography featuring women and trans men of color.
My name is Trick, and I am a queer woman of color, and butch, I guess a new school term would be masculine of center. I'm also a leather daddy, top switch, dandy yes. fag. A lot of people like to call me Gramps for some reason. so, yeah, I have a number of monikers.
I love that. I live. Okay. So let's just get right into it, Trick. How did you begin this business venture of producing porn?
Well, I was in a porn in 1996. That was my first one when I was a baby dyke at 24. And then I was in another one 10 years later. And in between that, I ran around with a radical bunch of queer folks in San Francisco. And those folks and I, we put on live sex shows, basically. There's underground sex shows in San Francisco that were pretty popular. And so I basically, my professional career was an audio engineer in a union. And so while I was being an audio engineer on the side, I would do porn and sex work.
And how do you feel like your identity played a role or didn't play a role in your initial porn and or sex work?
Sex work and porn has always been an interest of mine, and being in a union, it was stressful. I was responsible for a lot of people. It was pretty tiring at times, a lot of hours. So I basically began an exit career and figured I wanted to do something more creative. And porn seemed like a really good opportunity to combine a lot of my interests and a lot of my passions. I love filmmaking. I'm a movie buff. I love sex. Queer people of color I wanted to work with, travel, fashion, music. So it just seemed like a really good place to showcase a lot of my talents. So I decided that porn would be my second career in life. And I think it really, my identity definitely is crucial to producing it because, you know, I am Vietnamese and black, so I represent people of color. I definitely am gender fluid, so sometimes I, you know, look like a, most of the time I look like a man in society's eyes, but I, you know, can look a number of different ways. Sexually speaking, I'm all over the place. I just really enjoy people. So I wouldn't really pinpoint, I don't have a specific like. So all of that said, it was just really easy since I was in it to get people to be part of this project. And really it's about changing the face of sexuality and presenting real, authentic queer people of color and showing authentic pleasure. Porn severely lacks pleasure, so that's what I'm trying to show.
So how is the work that you're doing with queer porn, right? So genderqueer, fluidity.
Yes.
How is that pornography different than what we have traditionally known as black lesbian porn, black gay boy porn? How is the work that you're doing different from what already exists kind of in the mainstream notion of gay and lesbian porn?
Yeah, the a lot of the producers have been not from the community. So traditionally, you know, women, queers, people of color, they pretty much the searchable categories that you can look up in porn, it all comes from a place of exploitation, commoditization, you know, fetished, hypersexualized. That kind of porn is damaging, I think, to society. For the queers who are making porn, there's definitely a new school of pornographers coming out, and a lot of those producers that are queer people of color are also trying to represent queer people of color and our communities and marginalized communities. I think that basically my porn is more about trying to show sexual chemistry and pleasure, as well as more of a movie look to it, rather than just gratuitous objectification. I think there's definitely some queer porn out there that is popular. A lot of people like it, but you know, I think my porn it kind of stands out because it is basically it's you know pleasure based, and there's custom soundtracks over it. Also, my goals are different, I think, because I am trying to provide a work environment that's safe and equitable. I'm trying to have everybody tested. I'm trying to create jobs for queer people of color. I want to hire queer people of color. So it's much farther reaching in terms of queer people of color. And I want to support local communities. I want to go to, you know, New York, Chicago, Kentucky. We'd love to run through Kentucky and see what kind of beautiful freaks you guys have.
I'd love it too.
So you know, I want to get crews in different locations and chocolate cities and make sure that we hire our community.
Let me ask you this, Trick. Someone like me, for example, and Doc can attest that I'm a bit of a prude, right? And perhaps that is because I grew up Catholic. I grew up here in the conservative South. But it's very interesting to me, the work that you're doing, because it comes from a very liberated place. It comes from a very sex-positive, empowered place. Yeah. So how have you always had the sense of self-empowerment that porn is not bad, that sex is not bad? These are things to be celebrated and enjoyed. Have you always felt that way? Is that something you had to come to realize? And perhaps do you have some advice for other people, perhaps, who, even if it's not shame, it's a bit of a reservation about embracing the whole notion of sex as a good thing? Talk about that for me a bit.
Sure, yeah. I've always been pretty sexually liberated. When I came out, I think, 17 or 18 years old, and I just started experimenting right away. I mean, I was like, well, this is, you know, I just wanted to get my hands on everything and try everything. I think,
no pun intended.
You know, everything and everyone, definitely. I came out like a bat out of hell. I think that, you know, people have generally a negative attitude about sex. This society has a negative attitude about sex, and I just didn't believe it. I knew that there was good porn out there, and there's good sex out there. And so, a lot of my life, I just followed my interests and experimented. So, I'm definitely not ashamed of the fact that I don't fit into a box. That just because the basic, you know, box is, okay, you're female, you need to be feminine, and therefore you like men. That some people are like that, but queers are just so, we are just so much more wide, there's so much of a wider range of sexuality and gender fluidity. And so if I know that women are definitely socialized not to want to see porn. And I think, you know, that because there are these negative stigmas about porn, and a lot of those arguments are true, don't get me wrong, but there is good porn out there. There is good sex out there. And so I think if, you know, people start really being honest about their sex and sexuality and gender and wanting to know themselves, I think it would be really helpful to view my porn and check out the different people in it. We have, you know, butch on butch, we have butch on femme, we have trans men with trans men. I mean, I'm filming everybody who is under the umbrella of queer. So, you know, I know people are definitely conservative, and, you know, I think that's fine, as long as you don't have shame about it, because shame can just turn ugly. It just can really be ugly. Unhealthy attitudes lead to unhealthy actions towards people. So I think that it would behoove people to want to know, to get to know themselves and experiment. And as long, I think sex can be fun, aerobic, it can be funny, it can be creative, inspirational, it can be deliberately painful. But, you know, above all, it's got to be consensual. And there's got to be communication around it. And I think if people started opening up dialogue about sex and what they expect during sex before they have sex, that would change a lot. That would people would have a lot better sex.
Well, thank you so much, Trick. And thank you so much for agreeing to do the interview because it is your birthday.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. Okay. Well,
take care. And we'll talk to you soon. We look forward to seeing more of your work.
Yes.
Hey, Kyla, thanks very much. And I encourage listeners to keep listening to Strange Fruit and 89.3.
Yes!
Thank you so much.
Take care. The holidays are here. But for some individuals, the holidays are not always festive and not always welcoming. We spoke with Dr. Stephanie Budge to get her advice on how some LGBTQ people can cope with heading home for the holidays this season.
My name is Stephanie Budge. I'm an assistant professor in counseling psychology at the University of Louisville. I self-identify as a white queer woman, and I also use female pronouns, so I'm also a cis woman.
So, in preparation for the upcoming holidays, we all are aware, at least here at the show, that for LGBTQ people, right, the holidays doesn't necessarily represent a coming home or warm, fuzzy feelings. Sometimes it can produce anxiety, nervousness, right? Mm-hmm. Could you talk to us about some of the experiences people might have with the upcoming holidays, like describe some of their feelings?
Well, there tend to be a couple of different things that people experience. So when people are not out with their families, that's usually a major source of anxiety, because especially if they're college students or if they're living away from home, they can be who they are if they're out in their communities where they are. So it's a big source of anxiety to try to go home and then have to readjust being, you know, who you are for a large majority of your time and then having to hide that and feeling some of that shame around home. So that's one piece of anxiety. Another piece of anxiety is if students are out or people are out in their home community and then go home and they're out there, but they're not accepted at home. That's a different source of anxiety. So a lot of it tends to be related to the adjustment of how people are out and what that causes in terms of the kind of shame that they experience, as well as feeling like they have to hide who they are, even if they are out at home. So that's what I talk to a lot of folks about in therapy. Specifically, I'm a therapist, so this is where most of this stuff comes out, that we talk a lot about how can we plan out what you're going to do when you are not here to be able to make sure that you can cope with it.
Cool. Dr. Budge, what are some of the behaviors that you've heard in regards to how families treat LGBT folks? So are they yelling? Are they shaming folks? Are they cuss them out? Are they using the wrong gender pronouns? What kinds of things happen?
Well, to be honest with you, I think that it depends on the family, but most of what I hear is ignoring. So when I talk to people about what their family experiences are like, for the most part, they say, well, we just don't talk about it. Or I'm told that if I do bring it up, that I'm just supposed to go to my room. Or, you know, for the most part, it just tends to be a we don't talk about this here. There sometimes is yelling and there sometimes is some violence and aggression. But at least the people who I talk to in this weird way say they almost would rather have that kind of confrontation, because they at least know where their families are coming from and they feel like they can talk about it. But it's the ignoring and the not talking about it that is usually causing more stress, because it's kind of dancing around the issue or not knowing how to respond.
Now, your work focuses a lot on trans people. Are there specific challenges that trans folk face around the holidays, perhaps, that are different than what traditional cisgendered gay lesbian folk face?
Yeah, so a lot of the time what I talk about with a lot of the trans folks who I work with is that, you know, it's not helpful or healthy to compare people's experiences, because everyone has difficulty. But I think that where we are as a society is that people at least tend to understand what LGBTQ means to some extent. So families, while they may disagree or while they may disapprove, there's usually some type of dialogue or at least
a basic understanding.
Yeah. So when it comes to trans folks, there's usually just a lot of confusion or I don't believe that this is happening or this doesn't exist kind of a thing. And so that presents a completely unique challenge for a lot of trans folks within their families, trying to explain it in a way that maybe some other individuals don't need to.
Mm. Are there any situations where it's actually in an individual's best interest not to be with their respective family for the holidays?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that this is the same kind of conversation that I have with folks. I think there's this narrative in our community about you must come out and you have to tell people about who you are, but I don't actually think that that's true. I think you need to really take into account what you need for your own protection and for your own well-being. So the same goes true with this, that I think if your family is abusive or if your family is causing you such distress that you can't function or even that it's just so distressing that you're having a really difficult time, it's not worth it. And, you know, I'll help talk with people about here are some ways that you can communicate with your family, and I'll even meet with families and help facilitate that conversation with them. But at the same time, that's only one part of the solution. I don't think that it's always something that needs to happen.
Mm. Certainly. So here at Strange Fruit, we talk frequently about the concept of chosen families or what we have deemed gay families. And that is folks who are not related to through blood or biology, but folks who we've chosen to be brothers and sisters with or a gay mother or a gay father. Talk a bit about how those kind of support networks can be important to folks, especially if they're not connected to biological families.
Well, I think it's absolutely essential, to be honest with you. Even if you have a family of origin that is supportive, I even think it doesn't go far enough usually if they don't really have much of a concept of how to support folks related to their identity. I think a family of choice is absolutely instrumental. In fact, a lot of the research that I do is related to social support and how that actually helps buffer things like depression and anxiety. So when I talk with a lot of the people who I am meeting with therapeutically, I talk with them about not only how do you find a community, but how do you reach out to them when you're having a hard time?
Certainly.
Because that's the hardest part. So you can have a family of choice, but if you don't reach out to them when you're really struggling, then they're not going to be that helpful.
Can you give me some tips? So say, for example, I'm a person who goes home and my family, well, let's take the ignore scenario, right? So I go home, my family simply does not engage me beyond good morning, here's breakfast, there's not very many questions about school, about relationships. Are there some ways that my family isn't necessarily hostile, but perhaps they just don't want to address the issue? Do you have perhaps some strategies, some recommendations as to how kind of to begin to engage your family in those kind of discussions? Or should you just leave it alone altogether?
Well, you know, part of it is I first ask folks, how safe do they feel in their family? So it's finding out if you think that you're going to bring this up and this is going to make you less safe, then we talk about some other strategies that I'll maybe mention in just a second. But if they feel like their family will at least entertain the engagement, then I'll ask them, do you feel comfortable addressing this in person? If not, we talk about how can you write a letter to your family to start the conversation. So usually it's writing a letter. I don't recommend text messaging because, you know,
or Facebooking your mom. Should I not Facebook your mom?
Yeah, like, I think what's up? I know that writing a letter seems maybe a little archaic now, but actually family members seem to respond really well. You know, I think and have a couple friends read it for you, make sure that it seems like what you're saying comes out in a clear way, and hand it to your family and say, you know, I'll be here in 30 minutes, you know, go up to your room and then come back down and then you can address some of the things. If you don't want to do that, then what I recommend, if you don't feel like your family is going to actually talk to you, I recommend you actually setting up phone dates or GChat dates or texting dates with your friends, your family of choice, and actually setting up a time, because most of the time what you do is you tend to withdraw. So you enter a contract with your friend saying, you know, call me at this time or text me at this time and I'll make sure that I'll actually talk with you. And that way you actually have something set up where you have promised to actually engage and talk with somebody for support.
It's very interesting.
So in your experience in basically mentoring, speaking with, and, you know, observing LGBT people when it comes to anxiety around the holidays, how much of what some of your clients or maybe some of your students said in their experience does the bashing them or mm-hmm. hurting their feelings or yelling at them around the holidays, around their identity, mm-hmm. couched in religious reasons? Does the anxiety become worse because it's a religious holiday? How does religion play into, you know, the anxiety that mm-hmm. LGBTQ people experience?
Yeah, in my observation, it plays a great deal into most of the folks who I talk with. And in fact, I think even if they might not ascribe to some sort of religion, or even if they do, it tends to be a lot stronger at home. And especially, you know, oh, you can't bring your partner with you to our Christmas event, or you can't be out or wear that to our church event. You know, so I think that mm-hmm. what ends up happening is it's not just even a lot of it is overt bashing, but some of it are just the messages that you're getting around the holidays that you might not get at any other time.
Mm. I want to talk a bit about I'd like to talk a moment about sort of a duality. So you have mm-hmm. a person, perhaps, who's not from Louisville, who comes mm-hmm. here to go to school, returns home to small town Kentucky. Here on campus, they're out of the closet. They mm-hmm. are living in their preferred gender. They return home, have to revert back to a bio gender, or have mm-hmm. to go back into the closet. In what ways can that behavior be destructive? So how does it manifest? Are mm-hmm. folks suicidal? Do folks cut? Are folks depressed? Like, in what ways? Because some folks think it's easy. Well, just go home and be in the closet. Just go mm-hmm. back home, go to church, and wear pants and a suit. Is that good advice? Is that sound advice to kind of just play it by the rules until you mm-hmm. come back to Louisville? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the difficult part, kind of what I've answered throughout this time, is that you really have to find out where somebody is and how ready they are to do some of that. My personal belief on this, after working with people, is that any time you have to hide any part of who you are, that just indicates that there's something wrong with you from society. So specifically with the example that you give, if you let's say that you were assigned a male sex at birth and you're now identifying as female, for example, here in Louisville, and yes. you go back home and you have to wear, men's clothing and, yes. and do some of that stuff, that happens every time you have to put on those men's clothing or use your male name, that just tells you that you're doing something about you that's wrong, and that you shouldn't be that way. And it's like every single moment you do that, it's just like one stressor upon another one. And that does lead to things like cutting in order to release the stress, or, you know, feeling like, well, if I'm this worthless, then, you know, is life worth living? And that's where it does lead to some of those kinds of thoughts or actions.
So last question, can you just briefly give us and our listeners some very practical things that we can mm-hmm. do in the moment if we find ourselves in a high stress situation? So count to 10, take a walk. Mm-hmm. What kind of things can we do in that moment if we just need to debrief and kind of regroup mm-hmm. in a crisis situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that honestly, the thing that you mentioned that is to get yourself out of that immediate situation. So if you're finding that you're either panicking to some sort of extent
or getting really angry,
remove yourself from the situation, because all of those anger hormones that actually release are going to make it difficult for you to be actually thinking about what you're doing. So get out of the situation, do go for a walk. Or I even have people, when I talk to them about this, in that very moment, if you find yourself ready to boil over, make sure that you have a plan. So if reading calms you down, you have a book right there with you that you can just kind of mm-hmm. open up, or, go take a shower, yeah. something like that, where you know that you can get out of that situation immediately, calm down a little bit, and then come back.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing these strategies. Certainly the holiday time is very stressful, but thank you for sharing some tips to make it a little bit less stressful. So
yes, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
As always, another fantastic show. We have just really have the coolest guest. And as we mentioned earlier, y'all, this is our last show of 2012. So be sure to tune in next year and check us out. Continue to support us. So first of all, Trick Wolf.
Love Trick Wolf.
First of all, Trick Wolf is a cutie pie. The bad part about radio is y'all can't see these people we have in our studio. Y'all can't see the folks we have on the telephone. But the Trick is a cutie pie. And I guess it's fair to say that because you do porn. You're used to people judging. You know, not you don't do porn, but she does porn.
I've never done porn. I meant
Trick does porn. You in the sense of
goodness.
Trick does porn.
Okay.
So I'm sure Trick does not mind being sized up, you know, and saying you're attractive, you know, whatevs.
Oh,
You know, but so Trick is, you know, not only an attractive person, but also doing some really cool stuff to, you know, because some folks are into porn, you know, and of course, me being a good Catholic, you know, boy, don't do those kind of things. But for those who do partake, you know, it is cool to have some more diversity, to have trans men and women of color, and hopefully she'll be able to have some nice, handsome, biological black men up in there, you know, some young black stallions, some of her coming features, you know. Happy holidays to me.
Oh, my goodness. And wasn't Dr. Budge great on her advice?
Yeah, she was really cool, you know, because lucky for me and lucky for you, too, we have really supportive families. And even though our families are nuts and crazy, it has nothing to do, you know, with our sexualities. They're just nuts and crazy. But we do have some friends, you know, and you have students who don't have such welcoming and cool families. So we appreciate her sharing some coping mechanisms, because you might have a Grinch in your family, and she'll teach you how to, like, you know, deal with all those Grinches and make the best of this holiday season. So,
Great advice.
Do you have a New Year's resolution?
I don't make resolutions, because I feel like I don't like being told to do.
Well, if you're taking suggestions, I have a few things. I mean, we spend a lot of time together, child. I have a few suggestions. You don't want to tell yourself what to do, but I will gladly.
Oh, what?
I mean, no, okay. Well, but for real, I'll give you a few suggestions. No, this is what we'll do. Oh, okay. This is what we'll do, child.
What?
You give me a resolution for myself, and I'll give you a resolution for yourself, but we'll keep it cute, you know, like something nice and fun and festive.
Okay.
Give me like a resolution,
or like a
hope or something, like.
Okay,
You want me to find a man in the new year? Is that a good one for you?
That is not a resolution.
Chad, I'm resolved, honey.
Okay, no. My resolution for you in the new year is to trust your great mind and your great heart, and to be more assured in your talents, your intelligence, and your charisma.
And my unique disturbing talent. Oh, well, that's sweet. Okay, you better show my emotional vulnerabilities to our radio audience. Oop, you know what I want for you in the new year? Because I talk about this, child. I want you to really become that big star, that big cultural commentator, you know, because we have, you know, Melissa Harris Perry on her TV show, and Tavis Smiley, and even raggedy old Roland Martin, you know. But it's like, I feel like not only do you have brains and brilliance, but you have beauty, you know, and you deserve, you know, you have a face for television, you know, and you deserve, you know. So my goal, child, is to really be your manager, child. And we're going to get you on somebody's television station or somebody's reality show or something, child. You need to take the world by storm. So that's what we're going to do.
But I love you for the holidays.
And I love you back. And we also love, of course, our wonderful producer, Laura. We couldn't
do
any of this without her.
Laura is the best.
And she's so shy, she always edits her name out of, like, whenever we say something about her, she edits her name out and, like, cuts it out. But hopefully she'll keep it in. And, of course, shout out to the entire staff here at WFPL, who's been really, really cool to us.
And so, happy holidays.
Happy holidays. And we'll see y'all next year, okay?
Yes. Strange Fruit is produced by 89.3 WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Our producer is Laura Ellis. The views we and our guests express on Strange Fruit don't reflect those of WFPL, Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
For more information on Strange Fruit, go to WFPL.org, find us on Facebook, and visit us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod. I'm Jason Gardner.
And I'm Kyla Story. Thanks for listening.